Today's episode is really special. We've got Mike Rolls. Now, Rollsy, yeah, you were introduced to us through a mutual friend, John Perrott, and all he ever says is just how amazing a bloke you are. And I'm just pumped to sort of dig into your story, mate. It's such a unique one, but I think one of the more special stories in Australian golf and sport and just the things you've overcome, mate. So this is going to be a really exciting episode. For those that don't know, Rollsy is one of Australia's best all-ability golfers, played in the World Cup, played in the President's Cup, but also has a really unique story in how he got to that point, which I'm really excited to dig into, you, mate. So thanks for coming on board.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, buddy.
No, awesome.
Looking forward to it.
Let's jump into it, mate. So early journey in sport. Tell us a little bit. Pez has told us that you used to rock a pretty long haircut, potentially a skater boy back in the day. And
footy. I'm ashamed to admit this, but I played at Hampton Rovers with John, and my nickname was Hollywood because I had this absolutely rude, horrible haircut that was in a ponytail, no undercut. It was like, you know, the full thing, you know, the undercut was good. That was the fashion back then, but I didn't have one of those. I just had a regular head of hair, and I actually ended up selling it to a wig maker. So some poor bloke is probably walking around out there with a few feathers on top. Compliments of Hollywood from back in the Hampton Rovers days, mate.
And what inspired that? Was there a model
Just being young and thinking you were way cooler than you actually were. And I don't know, it just kind of grew. And then I kind of just kept growing it until I ended up looking like a bit of a, you know, certainly a pretty boy. And I was a bit soft in football, to be honest with you. John was the kind of guy that would get in and under and find the footy and then, you know, deliver it to me. And I just used to, because I was tall and I could kick it a long way. That was about all I had going for me at the time. Right. So, you know, but we had some success, and I love playing physical sports, footy, and just about anything. I remember, you know, being into any type of sport, didn't matter what it was. Mm-hmm. And I was into golf, but I wasn't so good at golf. I used to love playing golf. It used to frustrate the hell out of me, like it still does. I'm not saying it doesn't, but that certainly wasn't my major focus. I liked football, and then it became a little bit more serious when I sort of finally developed a little bit more. I certainly wasn't. I'm just a tall streak right now. I was never solid or anything, but I found my way into the Southern Footy League where I was playing at the age of 17. I was playing with guys that were, you know, a lot of them ex-VFL, some ex-AFL players played in that league. So it was a baptism of fire, jumping straight into the cauldron and playing against guys that were just smashing me every single week. And even though I was out of my depth, it was a great place to sort of learn and develop.
And so rumour has it you were the centre half forward.
I was a centre half forward. I got to crum off this guy called Frank Rigolo, who was like a fridge. You know, he'd stand there, he'd kick 50 goals, and I reckon he'd run about 200 metres for the whole game. He literally just used his bum to push people out of the way and take marks, and he'd just feed the ball to me, or I'd crum off him, and we had a really successful year. And then eventually, after our second season, we decided to go across to Tasmania on a football trip to celebrate a successful year with a bunch of great guys. And that was something I was really pumped about. Didn't have any money. I was broke, 18, didn't have a job at the time. I was due to start study the next year, but I had a bit of a gap year, a bit of a year off. And then convinced my mum and dad to pay for the trip to Tassie with my team, and they did. And we went across there, and I remember giving my mum a kiss goodbye and jumping in the car with my teammate going out to the airport. And then that was actually the last memory that I had. The very next memory I have, I wake up after a 5.5 week coma back at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. And it turns out, you know, that they'd basically just broke the news to me that I'd been very ill. I'd been in a coma for 5.5 weeks and I'd contracted meningococcal septicemia, which we've all heard about it. It's a super rare form of bacterial meningitis and affects, you know, only a handful of people get really ill, lose limbs or die in any given year. It's around about 1 in a million chance of getting it. So it's a really rough thing to catch. You develop septicemia, your blood starts to turn to, I guess, glue or slime, and it can't pump. And what that does is it results in multiple organ failure, which is what I had. I had bleeds on the brain, kidney failure, liver failure. And I was in some serious trouble, and also the physical injuries, because your blood can't pump properly. They have to, it forces the need for amputation. Mm-hmm. So parts of my body literally started going black. My fingers, missing a couple of digits on my right hand there. And also my right leg had to be taken off below the knee. And in those early days, my left foot had to be removed as well, and a lot of skin grafting up and down the leg as well, which was absolutely devastating given I was so sporty and I relied on, you know, being able to do things from a physical perspective, anything I wanted. And then all of a sudden you wake up and you're faced with the sobering news that, you know, you're not going to be able to ever do anything again, they're telling you basically. So, look, that was certainly a very, very difficult period, not just for me. You know, when things like that happen to people, I've got a very supportive family. It happens to everybody. My parents went through probably something that I'll never even understand, something even tougher than what I was going through. While I was having a sleep for 5.5 weeks, they were having to make decisions about amputation. I'll never understand what they went through, but they've been, you know, my whole family's been with me, you know, every single step of the way. And, you know, to skim over all the dark days, because it's not a dark story. It's a light story. I live a happy, healthy, fulfilling life. And that was just one thing that happened to me when I was 18. And it was a big thing. It was a significant thing, but it was something that I've learned a great deal from. It was a long road. I had to go to, you know, finally went to rehab after a few close calls with, infection in the lungs and these sorts of things. I almost checked out a couple of times, which was a few close calls, which is pretty awful. Then I got to go to rehab at Caulfield, which is where they originally used to send the it was built to house the returning war veterans, and they haven't done any upgrades since about World War One. So it was this disgusting joint with this thing called a breezeway. I was in a wheelchair, and they used to wheel me up to the rehab, and then eventually got filled with the prosthetic leg. And you know, those were some pretty dark days, because it was, you know, pretty sobering that, you know, you have to learn to, first of all, sit on the side of the bed and then put a leg on, stand up and basically just build your strength the best way you possibly can. And then finally, after 6 long months, I got to go home. And I was, you know, I remember those early days just being totally just, you know, in total despair about, you know, not being able to play footy and not being able to do any sport for a very long time. And I remember specifically, you know, my mindset sort of went down into the gutter, and I started to ask a really destructive question. I started to ask, why me? And I think we all get to a point where we continue to ask that question if we're not overly impressed with our situation in life. And it tends to snowball. It can be really destructive in all areas of your life. You start to lose a bit of hope. You lose focus. You're not focusing on the future. You're looking at what's behind you and what you want to go back to. And unfortunately, in life, you can't do that. And I remember that change one day when, you know, I'm very, very close with my dad. We've shared some amazing experiences right throughout my life, being close with him. Some of my greatest memories were him taking me down to play one of my favorite courses of all time, the Dunes. He used to drag me out of school, you know, without my mum knowing. He used to say, "Hey, listen, do you want to? What are you doing after lunchtime, mate?" When I'm in year 9, and you know, I remember saying to my dad, "Oh, you know, I'm going to be at school, mate. What do you reckon?" And he goes, "No." He goes, "Be waiting out the front gate, and I'll pick you up at lunchtime, and we'll nick down and play golf down the dunes." And he goes, "But don't tell your mum." He's a legend, my dad. So we had some amazing times, you know, bonding times down at the dunes, and golf was always just a fun thing we did together. Not something that I was ever really good at. I reckon I was probably on like a 12 or 13 handicap, maybe. I had a very bad temper back then. Used to spit the dummy, you know, things didn't go my way or get a bad bounce. I'd spit the dummy, a little bit of a hothead. But I remember one day I was sort of home from rehab, and I was in a bit of a bad way. I think Dad kind of picked up on that. He knew I needed some help and a bit of a gentle nudge. And he popped his head into the room, and I just planned a nice long day in front of the TV on a Sunday, because it was a long, long week at rehab, and we all liked those days.
Yeah. This was pre-Netflix too, wasn't it? So limited options. Yeah, mate,
that was, I mean, I was literally, all I had was pretty much Bert Newton and shopping to choose from. Or Jerry Springer, actually. Jerry Springer back then. God, did I while away some hours watching a bit of Jerry Springer? Only so many books you can read, and I had my issues with my memory and stuff, so my concentration levels weren't great as either. But anyway, I stick his head into the room, and he kind of, it was a nice sunny day, and he goes, "Hey, Mike, do you want to go for a bit of a drive?" And I straight away, you know, reverted back to the why me thing, and I thought, well, you know, what does that actually mean? Going for a bit of a drive, it means I'm going to have to get into my wheelchair. It means I'm going to have to put the prosthetic leg on. It means I'm going to have to transfer, and then I'm going to have to, you know, jump in the car again and put my seat back. And all those things are going through my head, and I'm thinking all that equals is pain. And all I really want to do is just lie down and watch telly, to be honest with you. I didn't really want to do that. So I fired all these excuses at my dad. And he kind of, like, I could tell he was a bit determined, a bit, you know, really wasn't taking no for an answer. And he's kind of like, you know, come on, mate, we'll just go for a quick drive. And ends up convincing me, and we go jump in the car, put my seat back so I'm comfortable. I've got my prosthetic leg on, and this little bootie that I had for my left leg at the time that I used to wear. And I was only just learning to stand up. I was still very, very weak, very skinny, in a lot of pain. And we started to head down the, you know, 10 minutes down from my house in Sandringham, and he promised me it'd be just a 10-minute drive down the road. And when we got to the 10-minute mark, I gave him a nudge and said, okay, you said 10 minutes, that's 20 minutes away from bed, you know, take me home now. And he kind of just looked at me with this silly look and, you know, driving away, and he looks at me, he goes, come on, mate. He goes, 10 more minutes. So he continued to drive, and I bit my tongue, and then he keeps on driving, and we're getting further down the coast towards the Mornington Peninsula, and he keeps driving, and I'm starting to get really pissed off with him, and his stubbornness, and, you know, realizing that he's not really being fair. He's not understanding sort of how much pain I'm in and how much discomfort I'm in. He's only thinking about himself. So I kind of cracked it after about half an hour. I sort of say, mate, you're being really unfair. Turn the car around right now. You know, it's an hour away from bed. I'm really sore. I'm tired. I'm in pain. Take me back. I can't handle much more of this. And he, you know, same look. He sort of just shrugged it off, and he said, oh, 5 more minutes. And he kept on driving. And then we get way down the coast, and all of a sudden he turned the car into the dunes golf course driveway. And I looked at him and I said, what the bloody hell are we doing here, Dad? And he looks at me, he goes, oh, I've just got to go up and take a quick piss. And he parks the car and he leaves me. And I'm thinking, what a prick, you know, like that's really
long way to drive to take a slash.
Just so I can have a piss. I mean, surely there was a servo or something, right? So he nicks off, and I was waiting there, seat back and not knowing where my dad was. And then all of a sudden I look up after about 10 minutes and he's driving back in a little golf cart. And I'm thinking, what is he doing now? He opens the door and I screamed at him. Like I was pretty pissed off. I go, what do you expect? You know, what the hell are you doing with that? And he looks at me and he goes, well, you know, why don't we go for a bit of a drive up the fairway? And I straight away reverted back to all those excuses again as to what I couldn't do. And I was telling him, I was throwing them at him. You know, I was saying, mate, I'm not going to be able to get in a cart. I'm only just learning how to get into a car. I've got the seat back, got this leg on. I can't do this. And he goes, it's okay. He goes, we'll just go for a quick drive up the first fairway, and then we'll turn the car around, put you back in the car, take you straight back home. And it's fair to say I'm not believing a lot of what my dad's telling me at this point in time. He's been taking the piss quite a bit. But again, he pushed me and pushed me, and I jumped in that cart and we drove up the first fairway of the Dunes Golf Course. And I've got to admit, when we got out there, sun on the face, in a place where we had so many wonderful memories, man, it was a beautiful thing, you know. I just got to be honest with you, I totally forgot about all the pain that I was in, and my mood sort of got a bit better. And as we're driving up that first fairway, I remember all of a sudden he stops a cart in the middle of the fairway again, and I'm thinking, what now? And I turn to him and I go, what are you doing? And he looks at me and he's got that same look, and he's actually snuck a 7-iron into the cart and he pulls it out. And he pulls a couple of golf balls out of his pocket and he looks at me really seriously and he goes, hey, Mike, why don't you try and have a hit? And I said, Dad, there's no way I can have a hit. You know, I've only just learned to stand up. I haven't got the balance. I know you want me to, but I can't. There's no way I can hit a golf ball. Again, all this negative stuff, these negative thoughts about everything I couldn't do started to sort of flood through. He sort of bargained with me. He says, what about this? What about I hold you up by your hips? You have one swing of the 7-iron, you know, see how you go. If you fail, no big deal. So Dad sort of gets me out of the cart and I get as balanced as I can. He's holding me up by my hips, and I dropped the ball on the fairway and I got as balanced as I could with that little stupid booty on the left side and the the clunky prosthetic leg that I had for the first one, which was, you know, a far cry from what I wear these days. And I got as balanced as I could. And I remember I got my grip, and it was kind of the first time I'd held a golf club since becoming ill. And I swung back, and as I came down, I made really, really good contact with this golf ball. It was like a flush. I don't think I've hit a ball that well for what, good 20 years, mate. So, I flushed this thing and just went like, literally went about, probably about like 140 meters, which is further than I hit a 7-iron normally. I don't know, maybe, you know, when things distort over time, like, you know, maybe it was only about 100 meters, no. But it felt good. So, yeah. Came out the middle of the golf club and I was just watching it sail down the fairway, and I was so, you know, chuffed with this thing. And my dad as well, he must have been chuffed too, because he's kind of looking up the fairway. He goes, great shot, Mike. He's completely forgot to hold me on it. He dropped me flat on my face on the fairway of the dunes. I remember him, like, he was freaking out, thinking that he'd hurt me, and I'd injured myself further, and he was dancing around and he's trying to pull me up, and I, you know, sort of rolled over, and I think I didn't hurt myself, luckily, but we both sort of had a bit of a laugh right then and there on the fairway. And I share that story a lot in schools and corporate. I think people can relate to it. I think we've all got someone in our life that pushes us, and that we need a push when we know, even when we don't feel like we need one, we do sometimes, to get out of a bit of a rut. And I was heading in a really dark direction. And my dad showed me that day that, you know, if I had any chance of overcoming something really, really awful and, you know, some massive, massive challenge, if I had any chance of overcoming that challenge, I had to stop telling myself all the things I couldn't do and start focusing on the things I could. And that's where it was born, Ali. I think my love for golf then, all of my energy and attention and all my frustration about not being able to play sport, like football and things I couldn't do, plenty of things I couldn't do anymore. I mean, tempting bowling was off the table with the old mitt, the old right mitt, all those things. Like I couldn't, you know, surfing was going to be a battle, or footy's not going to be on the table. You know, all those things that, you know, I can focus on all those things that I can't do, or I can start focusing on things like that I can do. And I'm thinking, well, if I can hit a 7-iron like that and I'm still learning to walk, well, you know, maybe that's what I can focus on. I can keep that, I can keep golf there as something that can keep me on track and be a form of rehabilitation outside of, you know, just your general, you know, physical exercise and these sorts of things. And from that day forward, I fell in love with the game all over again, and I've taken it more seriously. I played very casually, but a lot for many years. And then way down the track in 2014, which is a long way after 2001, you know, over that course of that journey, I ended up making a pretty tough decision to chop off my second leg, which was a result of having osteomyelitis, which is a bone infection. It would never heal. It would break down, caused a lot of pain. And eventually I just had enough, and I decided to amputate that dead weight that I was dragging around with me. It was a pretty big decision, but it was the best decision I ever made. Able to get a prosthetic leg on and then be more balanced, and then able to get down to a lower level of golf or a better handicap, because I wasn't dealing with pain anymore. And it sort of helped with balance. And prosthetic technology these days has come a long way. We're seeing, you know, sport-specific legs being made, designed, developed, and helping out. You know, I've got, for instance, my golf legs are different to the ones I wear every day. So my regular everyday legs are very rigid, don't have a lot of movement, and they give me a lot of feedback when I'm walking around. My golf ones are very more cushiony. They've got a lot more movement and allow me to rotate and twist a little bit better too. So in 2014, there was actually the World Disabled Golf Championship in Japan, and
that you start sort of the golf journey?
Yeah,
you
know, that like was it. Really. I'd never played a competitive round of golf in my life before that point.
So 2014 it starts, and you start at the World Golf Championships.
Yeah, yeah. So I've got a remarkable man, my coach Christian Hamilton.
Yeah, Christian from Golf Australia.
You know, he's a ripper. So he's been an absolute, you know, what he's done for All Abilities Golf has been unbelievable. He's a great mate of mine. We speak, you know, most weeks, and he calls me up and he says, hey, listen, you know, would you be interested in playing for Australia in the World Disabled Golf Championship? And I said, well, absolutely. And it was a bit unorganized back then in terms of the I didn't know much about amputee golf. I met a bunch of guys that played it who are far better golfers than I am. And we went across there, organized this trip, and it was a big thing. There was the other countries had our measure. They were polished. The Swedes in particular stuck out. They had a great disabled golf academy, and they flogged everyone. The Americans were really good. They had a playoff, you know, like they were. The Americans are obviously very good too. But we went across there to Japan and played at the One Way Golf Club in Tsukuba, which is north of Tokyo. And I remember so clearly my first tee shot. I like I said, I never. Sorry, my dog's just going crazy in the background here. Oi! Stop it. You'd edit that bit out, mate.
Now we leave it in. It's all part of Zoom calls.
So what happened was, I remember feeling, you know, I'm sure you've felt this too, when you feel really nervous before a competition, and the worst thing you can possibly feel when you're playing golf is nerves. You know, it's it's the worst thing ever. No, I mean, everything tenses up. And I normally, you know, I thought it's just a pretty much a straightforward 320-meter par four to start, and they call your name, pressure builds. And they say, Mike Rolls from Australia. I never, ever played any tournament before in my life. And I still remember so clearly, I put my three, I'll hit three iron. And that's a safe one. I'll hit three iron, put it in the middle of the fairway, and then we'll go from there. We'll sort of ease into it. And I teed it up, and I reckon I duffed it. It went about 40 meters. I just literally just almost cold topped this thing. And I realized quickly that I needed to get better at that. And then over the years, I got involved more, you know, representing your country and duffing it. I played horrible for the week. It was quite embarrassing, but it was quite a big learning curve. And since then, you know, obviously it's been getting more involved in club competitions, club golf, these sorts of things. And just, I guess, like anything in life, you want to get better at something that you're not good at. You've got to throw yourself in the deep end and you just keep doing it, you know, as uncomfortable as it is. The only way you're ever going to get better at something. Same thing with speaking. When I first started speaking, I was really nervous, and I thought, "Oh, this is, I'd rather be anywhere else right now." But you just got to keep doing it. It's repetition, you know, that you end up getting better, more comfortable with that feeling, and still get really nervous. But I've been lucky enough to be involved in events that you spoke about earlier with the World Cup of golf. That was an incredible experience. The All Abilities in Sydney at the Lakes was the first ever where we got to play alongside the pros, three rounds off the black tees, which was probably the toughest golf event I've ever been involved in. I feel like I could barely walk by the end of it. It was just brutal, but amazing at the same time. And then the President's Cup as well, where we had a feature event there for last year, which was the six best Aussies versus the six best international guys. And we got flogged, but it was an amazing experience and something that we'll treasure forever.
Mate, it's such an amazing story. Like, there's so much there to unpack. You know, like, my mind's been, as you've been going through that, like, some of those key moments, you know, like even going back to when it happens, when you're 18, you know, like having something like that happen to you at that age.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, how do you process that? You know, when you... Can you remember some of those darker moments and what that was like?
Yeah, I can. I remember I've always been a really optimistic person, loved life. There was certainly, I'm not going to lie and say that it was all, you know, hey, let's just get on with this, let's move forward. You're never going to go through, anyone that's been through anything significant, and we all have, everyone's been through something in their life that they can relate to, you know, a challenge that they're dealing with, and we don't know what people are dealing with, and none. You know, no challenge is bigger than the next. It's not a competition. We all go through tough times in our life. For me, it was such an unexpected thing. And I remember waking up and thinking to myself, you know, I didn't realize just how bad I was. You know, I didn't even realize I'd lost a leg straight away. I had a sheet across my waist and I'm thinking, yeah, I feel like shit. But, you know, I was totally unaware of the extent of the damage. So it was just baby steps at the time, and that's I think the big one is you've got to be realistic when you are coming back from some sort of depth. If you are in a crisis, I think it's unrealistic to make a big goal and expect to achieve it within a week. It's not the way, you know. I remember I used to hear that saying all the time: "What's the best way to eat an elephant? You know, one bite at a time." It's a really good one. You know, you can get an amazing amount. You can achieve an amazing amount if you take it bite by bite. And for me, it was always, my first goal that I wanted to do was to sit on the side of the bed and not vomit. You know, that was my big goal to baby steps. So that was the first step. And then it was to put a leg on, and then it was to stand up, you know, and then it was to walk a few steps and these sorts of things. And eventually it turned into, you don't realize it at the time, but it can be demotivating if you focus too much on the end goal. I got back to running, and if I had have sat there and go, when am I going to be able to run in those early days? I would have just gone backwards. So those small achievable steps. And also, I think sometimes we think about motivation the wrong way around. Motivation is something that can come and go. And, often people think, I wish I had more motivation so I could do the things that I want to do. I think that motivation comes when we are clear on what we want to achieve, our purpose. And I think it's also combining that with really good routines, not getting into bad habits, replacing bad habits with good ones, and getting into a good pattern. Or a good routine so that you can put those smaller goals in place and then achieve those larger ones down the track. So I guess that was what it was. It was bite-sized. And I'm certainly not going to say that it was all positive momentum. There was days when I had massive setbacks. There was days when I didn't want to get out of bed. Like everyone, we all have those really shitty days. And the important thing to remember is that, you are going to have bad days. The trick is just don't pitch a tent there. That was a really good bit of advice I had when I was in rehab. Is like, it's okay to feel sad. I think that as a society, we always want to just snap out of that. And it's a normal human emotion to feel sad. And, I often, in schools, what do you do if you're having a bad day? That's a good question that you get all the time. And you go, well, you have a bad day.
It just is. It's a bad day.
You have a shit day, and you try and make the next one better, and try and work towards something. If you don't like where it can't be a situation where we think that normal is living a great, fulfilling, goal smashing day every day of our lives. It's just not realistic.
I think it's such a valuable thing. Like we interviewed Anna Mears, and she was talking about.
I'm looking forward to watching it. I haven't had a chance yet. Oh, yeah, but she's what an incredible story. Yeah, Anna Mears.
Like her story is so incredible. And she talks about when she broke her neck, and it was like 2 millimeters, from completely being even more severe than what it was. Yeah. And it was that mindset of, as she uses the term, it's not what if. It is what is, and that's kind of the mentality that she went with. And it's really relative, isn't it, when you're facing a challenge? Like on one side, it's like, I've lost all of this, but on the other side, well, I've got all of this. And I could just see that in your story, like even from reading your book, which I highly recommend, and we'll put a link to that there. But like you talk through that process, and I think there's so much value in that around, the prune process. Like tell us a little bit about the prune process that you've got in there, like just at the high level, giving too much away.
I guess I'm not a writer. I'll start by saying that. It's something that I didn't sit down. I'm a one book person. Like there's, people, I meet people that are, writers, and the process was a really interesting one. And I thought, first of all, you've got to understand that it's not about me. That's the first thing. It can't just be, if it's a story, it's a story. That's great. But I guess the big thing was, what is it about the story that can help other people and that they can relate to? Because how do you take something that, is unthinkable, like, waking up with, missing limbs is probably the stuff of nightmares. It's probably everyone's worst, or waking up and, you've been in an accident, you're quadriplegic, or, I meet a lot of people with physical injuries. Those sorts of things are stuff of nightmares. So how do you get people that maybe haven't experienced a major health crisis, how do you relate to them with a story like that? That's probably was I guess the biggest challenge, because otherwise, if you talk about meningococcal and you talk about this disease that affects 1 in a million people, then people can kind of go, that happened to that bloke, but how does it sort of help me? So you have to work out, what was it about the story that can benefit others? And it really came down to that decision 9 years after getting sick originally, where I was sort of in a pattern where I'd recovered, but I hadn't really recovered. I'd still had a foot that wouldn't heal, and I was treading water, and I was kind of like, I remember using this expression a lot where I'd say, it is what it is. We all say that one. I love that one.
You'll be right. Say, it is what it is.
Yeah, it is what it is. And people use it when they you know, when they're talking about things that they can control, and the reality is that it doesn't have to be what it is. If you're talking about things that you can't control in life, then that's a good saying, you know, because, but I remember using it about my foot. You know, I used to think, oh, you know, I get pain and I have to sit down, or I'd lie down in bed for a few days because my foot would break down and I'd have to bandage it up and I'd get in a, you know, a mucky area on or whatever. And it was just my norm. And I remember thinking, you know, I didn't really give it a lot of thought because I was probably a bit scared too. You know, it was a fearful thing to think about. I knew deep down inside what I needed to do, and I needed to face up to, you know, that it was a real problem and it was taking away from my life, but I kind of ignored and I swept it under the carpet. And that was, I guess, where the messaging was born from. I think we all do that in our lives. I do it now even. You know, I think there's things we need to address. We know we need to address them, but we kind of shelve it and we ignore it and we expect either someone else to deal with it or just to get better on its own. And reality is often that's not the case. You know, we need to sometimes be proactive. And I think that the tipping point or the straw that broke the camel's back was when one of my doctors at Caulfield, I went for a checkup, she kind of like, she hit me with some truth. It's a really sobering thing when someone just tells you what you need to hear. And she unwrapped my foot one day and she looked at it and she goes, I don't like the look of that foot. And I said, neither do I. It's ugly, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And she goes, you know, you've got an, and she sent me off some scans. Turns out I got an infection in the foot. She goes, Mike, you know, your body's always going to be fighting an infection. It's going to be running at about 70% of what it could be. And I remember thinking, God, you know, she sort of said, you know, how do you feel all the time? And I'm like, no, okay, I guess. She goes, what about your energy levels? I go, they're not great. You know, I'm 28 at this point in time. Energy levels aren't great. My pain levels are through the roof. And I kind of sort of started to, she sort of pointed out all these things that I needed pointing, you know, I needed someone to point them out to me. And she goes, you know, it's because your body's always fighting this infection. It's never going to heal itself. That's why you feel like shit all the time. And I remember thinking about it. It forced me to think about it. And I remember thinking, well, my right leg, which is the one I wear a prosthetic on, is my strong leg. You know, I'm always limping around on the other one. And then I started to think about it. Well, how can I fix it? How can I get to the bottom of the problem? Instead of asking how can you manage a problem, maybe ask a different question, which is why? Why is the actual problem occurring? And it was because I had a foot that would never heal. So I think I made the decision then and there to, you know, it was pretty drastic. I had a lot of advice from doctors to say, don't do that. Don't amputate your leg. You know, why don't you try and fix a foot first, put a flap from your back and, you know, stick it on your on your foot and hopefully that'll heal and create more padding. And Mike, by the way, it'll mean, you know, you're going to be in hospital for probably another up to 6 months. And I remember thinking, you know, fuck that. You know, I'm not going to get back in a hospital bed for 6 months. I'm just not going to do that. So, yeah. Winton's found a surgeon who's probably, you know, one of the most remarkable men I've ever met. He's a little wizard, amazing at what he does. He's the most, you know, one of the most respected plastic surgeons in Melbourne, if not Australia. He does a lot of charity work for Interplast, who I'm an ambassador for. And he looked at me one day and he goes, what do you want to do with your foot? You know, when I went and saw him and showed him, talked about my problems, and he's the first one that asked me that. And I said, I want you to chop it off. Can you chop my leg off? So, you know, I said, he said, yeah, I can do that. It will be, you know, a tough operation, two stages, all that sort of stuff. You might need revision. And I eventually, I walked out of there and having made the appointment and, you know, really, really excited about it and telling people, hey, guess what? You know, 6 weeks, I'm having my leg chopped off. And everyone thought I was completely crazy. You know, as you would, you know, they're like, mate, Mike, you know, you've got one leg left, buddy. You know that,
not,
right?
Not a and normal like, sentence that you're expecting
really,
people having
really,
beers,
I've got
right?
One leg. I didn't realize I've only got one leg left. Geez, thanks for letting me know. You know, yeah, like it was kind of like, but I had made peace with the fact that I, you know, with all the downside to that limb and how much that was costing me, it was really holding me back from living life, really. So operation was absolutely horrible. Wanted to bail plenty of times whenever we approach a really tough decision. And that's the process in the book that I go through is that we have doubt. And that prune process in the book, which is what makes up the chapters, the word prune, literally the word amputate comes from the Latin word amputare, which means to prune. Now, when you know, think about you know, why do you prune a bush or a tree or a shrub or something like that? You cut away the dead parts and you allow it to grow. And that was where the idea from the book came from, because it was a real growth moment. It was a getting rid of this dead limb, this dead branch that I was, you know, carrying around with me. It wasn't getting any better, and it was regenerating and allowing space in my life to grow. And I remember the recovery period was only about 5 weeks. The swelling went down enough so I could fit it into a socket. I stood up and I was relatively pain-free shortly after, and able to walk on two prosthetic legs and feel, you know, the sensation of walking around with limited or no pain for the first time in about 9 years.
Mate, that is one of the most incredible stories, you know, like just in terms of, and I love it in the book, again, how you map out the process of how you came to that decision and kind of weighing out the pros and the cons. Like,
Well,
when you think about the gravity of that decision, you know.
Well, it took 9 years, Ali. You know, realistically, it's like, you know, it's funny. It's funny about, like, you know, we all consciously try and live life with no regret, right? But I remember afterwards, I remember my regret was always thinking, geez, I wish I had done that sooner. It was always going in my head, oh, you know, if only I had done that 2 years after. But you know what? Maybe I wasn't ready to make that decision 2 years after. So what's the point of thinking about that? You know, it was a big decision. Maybe I needed 9 years to come to it. And it's certainly not a situation where, you know, telling people to go out there and amputate a limb. Like, it's a totally unique situation, but we all think about something. I guarantee you every single person that reads it thinks about something in their life they've been wanting to change, but they haven't. You know, it could be a relationship. You know, how often do we end up, you know, in a relationship that we're not entirely comfortable with? Could be a conversation that we're neglecting to have that's going to, you know, help our life. It could be a health issue. It could be, you know, bad diet, you know, lack of exercise, whatever it is. Something you're carrying around with you that that needs attention, but you're just not facing up to it.
Mate, it's such great advice, and I think such an important and valuable lesson for everyone. You know, like, that's what I love about it. Like, you hit it on the head there where, it's not about...
Trust me, it's certainly a valuable lesson for me too. You need reminding of it all the time, because these things creep in. They have a way of creeping in. So I'm kind of like, oh, you know, I need to take a bit of... That needs some attention right there. So it's a cycle. We've got to continue to do it because it's human nature. Yeah. We pick up bad habits, don't we, along the way, particularly with a golf game,
right? It's not just one decision, is it? Yeah, it's a continuous process. So you can't just set it and forget it. Like,
absolutely, yeah.
You don't just figure out the golf swing and then it's just perfect.
I'll tell you one thing. It was a more simplistic process than trying to work out my demons in when it comes to golf. You know, my leg was... Look, I had a stuffed up leg. I'd look down at it. I go, that needs to go. I got rid of it. You know, how do you get rid of negative thoughts when you're in your backswing? You know, those sorts of things are probably a little bit more difficult. So,
mate, it's full on, and like, I completely agree. So tell us a little bit more about the golfing journey. You know, so you start off essentially 2014. You have that amazing moment with your dad. You know, just even touching on that moment
that was. After I realized I could maybe golf was something I could sink my teeth into.
Flushing
then it. I joined Kingston Heath. Yep. So I was a member there for 8 years. I loved being a member at Kingston Heath. What a wonderful golf course. Still got a lot of, a few good friends down there. And then eventually when I had my leg off and I had a fair bit of recovery period, I couldn't really justify spending money on a golf membership. So I let it lapse, and then I was no longer a member at Kingston Heath, but we'd go down the coast. We've got so many great, talk about being blessed in Victoria. We've got so many great golf courses that we can go and play. We used to go and play Eagle Ridge and the Dunes and, get a game on the National every now and then, up to Ainsbury. We could go down and play. Like, all these, you know, it was great. We had the variety. And then eventually, got to go over and play Japan very poorly. And I realized I needed to sort of get better. So I had a little bit of coaching. Never had any coaching before that. I kind of just sort of self-taught.
Well, what's your handicap at Japan? Did you have a handicap at that point?
It was probably around about 8, I'd say, 8 or 9 at that stage. So not wonderful.
Still pretty good without coaching.
Yeah. And then it was more so I knew the last round was the best one, because I remember having a conversation with Christian. I still remember this so clearly. I had so many demons after 2 days. I'd get on the tee and I'd imagine shanking it. You know, I was all over the shop. And I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing here? Who would have chosen this idiot to represent Australia who can't even tee a ball up and get it, you know, down the fairway? There's no way I can do it. And I remember, you know, having a conversation with Christian. I go, look, I don't think I can play tomorrow. I'm no good. I'm really a rubbish, you know, I'm playing rubbish. I don't think I can do it. And he looks at me and he goes, mate, he goes, would you just go out there tomorrow, tee the ball up, hit the fucking thing down the middle of the fairway, please? You know, and I'm sorry about swearing, but he was just like, don't overthink it. Just get up there and bash the ball down the middle of the fairway. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I could probably do that. And the third round I actually played, it was the best round I played. I was like, yeah, okay, I had nothing to lose. You know, I wasn't in any danger of setting any records. And unfortunately, I felt really bad about that because my teammates played wonderful. Jeff Nicholas, an amazing golfer. And Shane Luke were playing extraordinary golf. Shane Luke's incredible. If you ever get a chance to interview Shane-O, he had a lot of people, you know, that watch a lot of golf would have noticed Shane. When Tiger Woods was here and hitting balls across the Yarra, he actually grabbed Shane's prosthetic leg. Because Shane-O got up there and he goes, would you hold this for me? And he took his leg off and gave him the leg. So I got to hit this shot without his leg, and you should see him hit the ball. It's a sight to behold. He takes his leg off when he drives it and he rips it at 240 metres. One of the best golfers I've ever seen play with one leg. So it was a really great experience, but I realised that, you know, if I'm going to play these sorts of events, I need to get better at competition. And I started to think about, you know, well, I joined a club down at the National. I started to play a few competitions down there and a lot of amputee competitions as well. There's some great events that New South Wales Amputee Golf run. I'm president of Amputee Golf Victoria. We formed a couple of years back. We play at Ballarat. We were scheduled to play in April at Victoria Golf Club, which we locked in. Unfortunately, with the stupid coronavirus, everything was on hold, so that's been postponed. Victoria Golf Club, what an amazing track that is. So hopefully we're going to get some really good, some of the better boys were going to come down from all around the country and come play the Vic event. And also there's things like the All Abilities Championship at Kingston Heath this year, which I'm not sure what's happening on that front, whether it's going to be run or not. And the top four ranked Australian golfers, All Abilities golfers get to play in that event at the Aussie Open every year. I think I'm number five, so I'm out of it at the moment, which is okay. Because I want to get there on merit if I'm going to play in those sorts of events.
Mate, I remember watching you play at the World Cup, and that was the first time I'd seen All Abilities Golf.
Yeah.
And I think you just joined us as a member at that time. So we'll follow you around. And it was mind-blowing to see how good the quality of the golf was. Like, I remember sitting there and just following it for 80%, 90% of the day.
Who'd you follow?
You guys. So we were following you guys.
Was it on the rainy day or?
It was. Yeah, I think it might have been. Oh, I'm trying to think back now. It was.
So the Spanish guy with the one leg.
Yep.
Yeah, Juan Postigo. The European Tour Instagram page just posted a picture of his swing. It's like poetry in motion.
It was the most amazing thing.
The most amazing short game, and he's so him and Brendan. Brendan's got short stature, little Irish guy.
Yep.
Really lovely fella too. He plays off scratch and we played. So my teammate was Tony, my great mate from Western Australia. He's got one arm. He got electrocuted when he was 16, went right through his body and blew out his hip and he lost his entire arm. So he plays with his right hand where he just swings it backhanded.
Mm-hmm.
So it was me and Tony versus Juan and Brendan. And man, did we have our work cut out for us. I think that was something like 2 under through 9. And we were sort of keeping up with them, and I thought, yeah, we're playing great golf here, but they're you know, it's another level. Those guys are. I think we can match it with them on our best day, and we can continue to work on it. But you know, geez, the way they were playing, they were taking some. I think they were actually ahead of most of the actual professional groups when they finally came in. They were beating their scores. Were actually beating some of the guys, and one has one leg and doesn't even wear a prosthetic. He just crutches around the course.
Yeah, I think that tournament really put All Abilities Golf like on the map.
Yeah,
you know, because after that tournament, that was what everyone was talking about. You know, like there's a World Cup, but like the storyline.
We had that at Sydney. Abilities the week before. We had that at Sydney, and we had people come out to us saying, you know, people that weren't golf people, like caterers, were coming up to us and said, oh, you know, I hate golf, but when I came out the balcony, I saw you guys come through. I loved watching that. You know, so there's a real story element to it. And 100%. I think that there's also an added bonus is the fact that everyone is, I think it's a universal understanding that golf is a really difficult game when you've got all your limbs. It's a tough game anyway. So, well, when you've got it, when you're physically well off, there's another amazing golfer that was part of the All Abilities and also the World Cup called Adam Wabi from Belgium. I'm not sure if you saw him. He has cerebral palsy and he gets around. He's an unbelievably good golfer and has a lot of issues with his movement below his waist. So he has some weakness in his legs and he uses crutches as well, but just gets on with things. And I had a lot of members from Metro. They've got an amazing GM down there who's very forward thinking, and he gets behind Peter Packinen gets behind all of the All Abilities stuff and has been an amazing supporter of mine and All Abilities Golf ever since then. And so have all the members. You know, it was some of the feedback that we were getting from the members was amazing. I remember on the second day I played with Steve Pryor from Sydney, an amazing golfer who lost his hand. He plays with an attachment. And we were going up, I think, the 15th hole, which is a par five. And one of the volunteer members was standing on the rope. And I think we were one of the last groups through. And Steve hits the ball an absolute mile with one hand, right? So he's got this attachment. He rips this ball. It goes right down the middle of the fairway. We're playing four ball, better ball. And we got up to the member and on the ropes, and he's standing there. As we walk up, and he shook his head and he goes, I've been standing here all day. And he goes, not one of the pros has hit it past that ball. And Steve, you know, kind of just, you know, does the old, he was quite chuffed with that. And it's true. Like, he hits the ball an absolute mile. And for people to see that, I think that's, you know, once you get past the wow factor, you actually say, well, we put a lot of time and effort and we work hard on our game too. So it's not, you know, I'm certainly not in the top two couple of guys or anything. And I'm happy with the way I hit the ball, but some of those guys are probably in a totally different ballpark to me.
And I think there's such an incredible story. Like, when we're looking at, you know, one of our missions of growing the game in golf, like, I think All Abilities Golf helps put it all in perspective around how much of a mental game it is and how it doesn't matter what your size, shape, age, gender, whatever it is. It's one of the only sports uniquely, like, even though there are existing barriers and there's a cost to play golf, but fundamentally take away all that traditional stuff. Yeah. And the game itself is probably one of the most equal games once you've got a club in your hand and the ball out there that, like you said there, like, you know, you guys are doing exactly the same thing as what the top pros in the world are doing. Like, it's mind blowing. Like, that's
it's one of the, so Christian, again, who's the, I think his title is National Inclusion Manager for Golf Australia. He says it best when he says that golf is inclusive by design. So the way that the games can be set up is that you can put everyone on a level playing field. But I think that we kind of in many respects we underestimate the mental health benefits of golf across the board, not just for people with disability, for everybody. And I think one of the best sayings that, you know, I've ever heard is, if you're feeling blue, touch green. And that's so true. You know, one of the things that I like to do is when I try my best is when I go and play golf, I turn my phone off and just be there, be present. And you've got 4 hours to yourself on a golf course doing something that you absolutely love. And that's why I haven't had a chance to have a game now that the restrictions have been lifted. But I understand that golf courses are like, you know, like South Melbourne Market is right now. They're just rammed. So I'm going to wait until everyone sort of gets it. Because so many people, you know, I'm certainly not advocating for Sam Newman, you know, being a bit of a goose and carrying on a bit too much. It's not the end of the world if we can't play golf, but it is something. And I think that the mental health benefits of golf can't be underestimated. For many of the guys in the All Ability space, I can certainly say that it's been a life-saving activity rather than just a sport. And I think that's something pretty special.
Yeah, I think you're right. You've touched on something there. Like, even looking at what's been happening in Victoria over the past couple of months, it's a unique emotional reaction to golf compared to a lot of other sports that have been cancelled. Like, the voices and the people that are vocalizing who are missing the game of golf, and I don't know whether we're just closer to it or not, but it's right up there. And I think it's maybe got something to do with how big an impact the game does have on the people that do play it potentially from that mental and physical health perspective. Like,
well, it's funny, Ali. So when you have, because I wear shorts all the time, it's very obvious that I've had challenges in my life. When for people that haven't met me, they, you know, it's amazing what people will talk to you about.
Mm.
There's that, I guess that, it's a real privileged position to be in, because you have members come up to you and they tell you their deepest, darkest secrets sometimes, and you've only met them for 5 minutes. And I think that's a really, I'm in a very fortunate position for people to feel comfortable to do that. And they'll talk to you about, you know, how golf has kept them, you know, on track over, you know, through divorce, or, you know, they've had a stroke and they've been able, you know, it's really helped them through their rehabilitation process. And not just from a sport perspective, but from a social element. You know, being able to go to the clubhouse and have a sandwich and a coffee with your friends. And even if you can't play, if you're physically unable to play, you can go there and you can have, you know, lunch with and just socialize. They have card games for people in the clubhouse. They have bridge for the ladies, and they have, you know, this amazing inclusive environment that is being created now. Whereas, you know, I guess it's always historically it's been kind of an elitist sport and unapproachable in some ways, and probably been a bit exclusive to people that maybe can't afford it, or people that, you know, I think that now we're getting to a point where it's becoming a whole or more of a snapshot of society, as opposed to just being full of you know, people that can afford it and Maseratis in the car parks.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's
thanks to, you know, thanks to what you've built as well. You know, if I can just say and congratulate you on that, is making golf more accessible for people, and giving them access to a range of different courses, and also you're helping the club so much in return too, and getting numbers up in what is a great game, and I think that's what it needed. It needed some disruption, and I commend you and what you've been able to build with Future Golf.
No, mate. Thanks heaps. Appreciate it. And, you know, it's awesome. You know, like, and I can't wait to share this episode, to share your story and you being a Future Golf member. And I think there's so many things out of this that will inspire more people to get into the game, especially people that are maybe not traditional golfers. You know, like, we're looking at it at the moment. Like, how do we get more families into the game? How do you get socioeconomic diversity into the game? How do you get all abilities? How do you get, you know, women into the sport? And I think that's hopefully what our platform can provide.
Build it and they'll come. Isn't that what they say? You know, like, it's about shouting from the rooftops that you have, you know, you have initiatives that welcome people. You know, I think that being overly overly transparent about it, and from a club perspective, if they advertise, they say, you know, we welcome people with disabilities. Mm. There's nothing wrong with saying that. We are an inclusive club. We welcome people from all walks of life. You know, that's a wonderful position to be in, and being, you know, not being shy about that. You know, I guess some clubs will probably take that on board, you know, easier than others. but hopefully that's where we get to, and hopefully golf clubs are become more of a, you know, not just a place to go and play golf, but more of I guess we start to capitalize on the benefits of the social benefits of golf too.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think you can see it shifting that way as well. Like, I think it's really important, you know, to still have private clubs with the tradition and that, call it the elitism. But I think there's enough space in the market for a variety of options, you know, and we're seeing now the success of things like Top Golf and X Golf and like Albert Park Driving, you know, like their facilities are Moore Park. And you can see that there's not just one way that we need to deliver the sport of golf. You can do it in 10, 15 different ways, catering to different markets, and it will work. And I think COVID is going to be a pretty cool opportunity for the sport of golf. It will show people that here's something that you can do pretty safely, you know, and while other sports are off.
Certainly is. And also getting the youngsters involved in the game with, like, beautiful, you know, great programs like the My Golf program from Golf Australia, you know, getting kids involved is a really important part of it. That's one of my biggest missions is getting more juniors involved in the game. So younger amputees involved in the game, because it's something that they can do, you know, forever. And as I said, keeps you on track. So it provides a whole host of benefits to people, and they're all different. So, you know, whether it's connection you're after, whether it's a physical endeavor that you want to do, whether it's something that you just want to incorporate into your life or get better at. It's a skill you want to acquire, whatever it is. It provides so much. The more people we get playing, the better. So the more clubs we keep open, the better.
I love it. And yeah, we're here to support any of your initiatives because it's completely aligned with it and believe in.
Mate, I'm going
to
hit you up on that. So be careful.
Yeah, mate. It's on camera. So that's done. Nah, but it's just love it, mate. And I think that, yeah, someone like with your story and the way you go about it, I think you're somebody that can have a really significant impact and already are having a significant impact on the sport. So we're all for supporting people that are doing that in that space, mate. And just sort of, I know we've taken up heaps of your time. So in wrapping up there, I know you did get to play around with Ricky Fowler.
I did. Yeah,
what was that experience like?
Play with Rick. mate, that guy is just, he is a cool cat. And that was really annoying. So I'm really fortunate. I get looked after by the guys at Puma. So shout out to the guys at Puma. They have some amazing gear. They look after me with my, my shoes, really comfortable shoes. Not that I'd know about that. they've been really good. And what happened was, because he's a Puma guy, everyone knows Ricky's a big Puma guy and Bryson, but that was way back. Oh, was that the World Cup, the previous World Cup? Mm-hmm. I remember I rocked up in the morning and they said, "Do you want to come and play the pro-am?" And I said, "Sure." And I thought I'd just be with someone from just a country that just a lowly country, whatever, just the guy that's there filling up, making up the numbers. And they cheekily organised me to go with Ricky Fowler. And I went to the team sheet at the start to register and they go, "Oh, yeah, you're with Ricky Fowler and on the 10th tee." And I go, "No, I think that's a mistake. It absolutely has to be a mistake. There's no way I'm..." No, you're playing with Ricky Fowler. And I remember just like almost, geez, how am I going to... because I just got new clubs and I'm like, geez, I certainly don't want to. I got started getting nervous again and everything like that. But it was okay. I got to meet him and what a lovely young guy. He was 5 under through 6 holes. So getting to see that up close, the way that he hit the ball, and it was almost boring. I remember thinking, God, how annoying would it be just to be able to put the ball wherever you wanted to put it? It's almost like watching, a computer game. It was just the level of control and spin. That was a pretty awesome experience. And it's always amazing to be able to see the good guys go about it. And just one last thing, quick shout out to the amazing Nick O'Hearn, who I got to meet at the Aussie Open in Sydney. We met in one of the lounges and just got chatting. And I've had some coaching since from Nick. And if you want to read an amazing golf book and shave shots off your game pretty easily, Tour Mentality is the book to read. The way he thinks about the game is next level, and what an amazing guy too. So he's been a really great supporter too. So
we love Nick. We love what he does, and he was on one of these episodes, and he shares so much gold in terms of how he approaches the game. And
amazing, he's mate, awesome.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to share? Where can people find you? What are you up to at the moment?
Nothing like that, mate. I just hope that continue to do what you do, promote the game. I think it's wonderful what you guys have been able to build, and I hope it goes from strength to strength from here. And also, I just hope that if anyone listening would like to come and have a chat about anything or any troubles that they're going through in their life, that they want to have a chat to someone that's been through also something, and you see me out and about, please come and say good day. I'm pretty approachable and friendly. So, I hope everyone gets back to golf and starts to enjoy the pristine courses we're going to be faced with when we get back out there.
Love it, mate. Well, just wanted to say thanks again. This chat was amazing. So many bits of wisdom and gold in there, and can't wait to share this out with our community and beyond. So thanks, awesome, heaps, mate. Rosie. Love it. We'll be following your journey.
All right. Thanks so much, Ali. Thanks for having me.
Legend.
Cheers.